loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, midterm elections were held a week ago today, but more than a dozen races are yet to be decided. The most inflammatory fight is in the Florida Senate race, where Governor Rick Scott, who's leading by only 12,500 votes out of more than 8 million cast, accused incumbent Democratic Senator Bill Nelson of voter fraud for asking for a recount. Scott is going with a scorched earth strategy to secure the seat, while in Arizona, Republican Senate candidate Martha McSally gracefully conceded to Democrat Kyrsten Sinema after falling behind by 38,000 votes out of more than 2 million cast. Next, special counsel Robert Mueller could issue new indictments in the so-called Russia investigation as early as today. Jerome Corsi, a figure on the right-wing fringe, told his followers in a YouTube video that he expects to be indicted on perjury charges today. Meanwhile, the media is speculating that several people close to President Trump and other friends of Republican consultant Roger Stone also could be indicted. Then, wildfires in Northern and Southern California continued to spread over the holiday weekend, resulting in 44 deaths and becoming the deadliest and most destructive wildfires in the state's history. More than 200 people are still missing. Meanwhile, President Trump tweeted that the fires are so severe only because of mismanagement by state fire prevention officials. That tweet was roundly condemned on both sides of the political aisle. And then a botched Israeli commando raid into Gaza late last night brought Israel and the Palestinians to the brink of war before Egyptian mediators convinced both sides to step back from the brink. Israeli forces killed 7 Palestinians last night, an action which led to the largest-scale rocket fire into Israel since 2004. An Israeli officer was also killed. And finally, I had occasion last week to sit in Athens with former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis and with renowned UBS whistleblower Brad Birkenfeld. We talked about whistleblowing in the financial and banking sectors and about Varoufakis' experience standing up to the Troika of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Central Bank, which was then in control of the Greek economy. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to those midterm elections. Midterm elections were held a week ago today, but more than a dozen races are yet to be decided. The most inflammatory fight is in the Florida Senate race, where Governor Rick Scott, who is leading by only 12,500 votes out of more than 8 million cast, accused incumbent Democratic Senator Bill Nelson of voter fraud because he asked for a recount. Scott is going with a scorched earth strategy to secure the seat, while in Arizona, Republican Senate candidate Martha McSally gracefully conceded yesterday to Democrat Kyrsten Sinema after falling behind by 38,000 votes out of more than 2 million cast. We're joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf, an investigative reporter and founder of This Can't Be Happening, as well as a columnist for Counterpunch and a contributor to the London Review of Books, The Nation, Extra, Tarbell, and Salon.com. Dave, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Dave, you have a good piece in This Can't Be Happening, saying that it's really all about voter suppression, that in part the reason why some of these races were so close, and indeed the reason why Republicans won in races that Democrats otherwise would have won, was because of voter suppression. Tell us about that.
Yeah, no, this is really something that's been an ongoing problem for several years now. The issue is provisional ballots and to some extent absentee ballots. And the reason these things are so prevalent is precisely because of voter suppression efforts that mostly Republican administrations around the country in states run by Republicans have put in place. And what they do is, you know, when they use devious means to get people wiped off the voter rolls, people come to vote thinking they're registered and find out that there's no record of them registered, or they will say your signature doesn't match the one and yet that we have on the voter registration document. And when that happens and a person knows that they are a legitimate voter, they're to be given a provisional ballot to fill out. And then they're supposed to come back and prove that they are, in fact, voters. So that's why there's so many of these provisional ballots, because there have been these very concerted efforts to throw people off the rolls illegitimately, the biggest one being this guy, Kris Kobach, who just lost the race for governor in Kansas precisely because of this, because the courts condemned him in no uncertain terms for what he was doing. And I think Kansans finally had enough of it, even in that very Republican state, and didn't vote for him. Overwhelmingly ousted him or kept him from winning. But what he did was he compiled a list of all felons in the United States and sent it around to Republican secretaries of state, suggesting that they run the list against their voter registration lists and then wipe everybody with those names on it. Except most of the names were things like James Smith and John Thompson and, you know, very common names. So everybody with those names were in Florida was wiped off, and in Georgia and in Texas and lots of other Republican states. And then those people come in to vote and they're told, oh, you're not on the list because you're a former felon. And they say, no, I've never been in jail. And they have to fill out a provisional ballot. So all this claim that these provisional ballots are some kind of conspiracy to steal elections by Democrats are complete malarkey. It's a response to Republican efforts to illegitimately throw really millions of people around the country off of the rolls illegally.
And one of the things that we saw in Georgia, especially in the governor's race, was the Secretary of State there, who was running for governor and indeed was elected last week, throwing people off the voter registration rolls if their signatures didn't match the signatures that were on file. You tell the story.
By the way, Kobach was running as the Secretary of State also for the governor.
Which is such a ridiculous conflict of interest. I can't believe that they both got away with it. But you tell the story in your piece about was it your dad or your father-in-law?
No, my father-in-law and mother-in-law. It's this, you know, it's such a common thing that your signature changes over time. When you register to vote, especially if you're an older person, you know, and a regular voter, you registered ages ago and you had a signature that looked a certain way. Then you get older and your hands get palsied like my father-in-law or arthritic like my mother-in-law, and your signature changes dramatically, right? And it can happen in only a few years when you're older because things go to hell, you know, pretty quickly. But even younger people, you know, when you're like 18-year-old and you register to vote, you have one signature. By the time you're 25, your signature has evolved enormously. So, but your registration is still the form you went in with originally, unless you stopped voting for so long that they dropped you from the rolls. So this claim that, oh, your signature doesn't match is complete crap most of the time. And so you have to fill out a provisional ballot and then come in and prove that you're you.
There's another trick too. And frankly, this is one I didn't even know about until I read your piece. And this is, you say it's a common Republican suppression tactic, and that is to send postcards to registered voters at their last registered address. They look like junk mail, and most people just throw them away. It requires you to buy a stamp and to place the stamp on it to confirm that you are indeed still living at that address. If you throw it away and you don't respond, you get wiped off the voter rolls.
That's right. That's right. This particular tactic is commonly used when, for example, you know, most places you don't have to vote every election in order to stay on the rolls. But some states will say if you miss a cycle, Republican states do this, if you miss a cycle, like say an off-year election or a city, you know, municipal election like next year we're going to have in Pennsylvania where like 15% of people vote. In some Republican states, that's enough to have you pulled from the rolls because you didn't vote that year. And then they'll send the card out to prove that you are a legitimate voter. The trouble is, for poor people, this mostly hits poor and minority people because they're renters. And what happens is a lot of people move. So in addition to throwing the card out because it looks like junk mail, it also goes to addresses where people don't live anymore because they've moved maybe down the block or around the corner to a cheaper apartment, or if their income got better, they may have moved to a better apartment. And the card just gets junked by whoever lives there in the new, you know, took over the apartment. So a lot of people who think they're registered come in and find out that they've been pulled off the rolls. And again, that's a provisional ballot.
I want to talk just for the last couple of minutes that we have about Arizona. I was listening to a variety of news outlets this morning, whether it was MSNBC or CNN or NPR, and they were all lauding the fact that Martha McSally, who is the Republican nominee for the Senate in Arizona, very graciously conceded yesterday, conceded that race to the Democrat, Kyrsten Sinema. And they were saying that this was really a return to kindness and to bipartisanship, blah, blah, blah.
What happened there was that, I think the grace actually was more on Sinema's part. She was the loser originally in the basic count. But they found that in some of the stronghold urban areas where she had more votes, overwhelmingly, there were a lot of these provisional ballots and absentee ballots that had been delivered late by the post office. And so they were insisting that those be counted. And McSally's campaign and the Republicans in the state objected to it and said, well, we have these absentee ballots and provisional ballots, too, in rural areas where we're stronger. And Sinema said, fine, you know, let's count all of them. And so the agreement was finally reached between the two sides that they would count all of them. And of course, she had far more ballots to be counted. So at that point, you know, the Republicans and certainly McSally did the right thing and realized that, you know, they weren't going to come through with their rural votes and win. So they did the, you know, they said, yeah, we accept it. But what else could they do?
You know, and I was going to add, and I hate to sound like I doubt the sincerity of Martha McSally, but the truth is that John Kyle, the senator who was appointed, the former senator who's now senator again, he was appointed to fill John McCain's Senate seat.
The other Senate.
The other Senate seat has been telling friends that he just hates being a senator and he's thinking of resigning again. And so the word is that Governor Ducey, who's a Republican, is going to name Martha McSally to the Senate anyway, so she might as well just concede, and then he could name her to the Senate next month or the month after that.
Right, so it would pay for her to be as generous as possible in conceding so that she won't have a lot of angry Democrats saying, oh my God.
That is exactly it. Well, these aren't going to be settled in the next couple of days, so we'll certainly keep an eye on them. We will leave it there. We were joined from Philadelphia by Dave Lindorf. Dave's an investigative reporter and founder of This Can't Be Happening, as well as a columnist for Counterpunch and a contributor to the London Review of Books, The Nation, Extra, Tarbell, and Salon.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Special Counsel Robert Mueller could issue new indictments in the so-called Russia investigation as early as today. Jerome Corsi, a figure on the right-wing fringe, told his followers in a YouTube video that he expects to be indicted on perjury charges. Meanwhile, the media is speculating that several other people close to President Trump and other friends of Republican consultant Roger Stone also could be indicted. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Welcome back, Daniel.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel, these really are fringe figures. Jerome Corsi is notorious. I'm not going to use the word famous, but notorious because he's written books about Barack Obama being a Muslim.
Born in Kenya. He started the birther thing.
Right. He started the birther thing.
9/11 conspiracy.
He's the Washington, quote unquote, bureau chief for InfoWars. He's a 9/11 truther.
He also says that that Bill Clinton had a love child named Danny, D-A-N-N-E-Y.
That's right. I forgot all about that. So this guy has made a name for himself as kind of a kook on the far right. He's lamenting the fact now that he's going to die in prison, which is what he told his wife. He just turned 72 a couple of days ago, and he's going to die in prison over a lie. So he's essentially confessing to lying in a YouTube video. And then there's Roger Stone. Everybody sort of knows about Roger Stone. And then one of Roger Stone's hangers-on, Michael Caputo, who has gone on virtually every network news program and said that he will not testify against Roger Stone. Well, now it looks like they caught him in some sort of a lie, And it looks like he may be indicted for making a false statement or for perjury or conspiracy or some such thing. So what do you make of all this? We haven't heard the word Russia in any of this, and we have all these throwaway felonies.
I think it's really just pathetic. I mean, I think that essentially Mueller is trying to indict anybody who has the who had any involvement, who he thinks he can pin any kind of involvement on. But if they're peripheral, they're unconvincing. I mean, I don't believe Stone really had any kind of connection with WikiLeaks. I think he was just bragging. I'm not sure if Credico did either. It's also peripheral. And I wonder why they just don't indict Assange, if they think Assange is really at the center of this conspiracy. But I imagine they won't do that because he's locked up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London.
And it might tip their hand.
Perhaps, but also would also embroil them in a huge legal battle as to get him out of London into Washington.
Indeed, I think that's probably right. What exactly is the crime that either Julian Assange or those people who may or may not have been in touch with Julian Assange are supposed to have committed? This is something that's been unclear to me from the beginning.
Well, they're supposed to have taken illegally acquired emails, emails that were acquired by Russia, and putting them out on the internet. So serving as a conduit for Russian attempts to manipulate the election. It's far from clear that happened. I don't think it happened, actually. But that is the central allegation, that WikiLeaks served as a conduit for Russian disinformation, Russian manipulation, etc.
There was an article in New York Magazine and nymag.com, the Intelligencer, that some people in the White House, Donald Trump Jr. expecting to be indicted by Mueller soon, is the headline. This is from a couple of weeks ago or a couple of days ago. Last year, Donald Trump Jr. testified that he never informed his father of meeting with Russian officials promising, quote, dirt, close quote, on Hillary Clinton. It seemed hard to believe that the ne'er-do-well son would neglect to seek credit for his expected campaign coup from the father whose approval he so obviously craves. And now it seems that Robert Mueller has obtained proof that it is not, in fact, true. The Trump family lies all the time, of course, but doing it under oath is a crime. This is from, I'm reading to you from this article published on the Intelligencer. Again, you know, if that was true, that Donald Trump Jr. lied about the fact that he had consulted or didn't consult with his father about the meeting at Trump Tower with the Russian lawyer who Rob Goldstone, the music promoter, said she had dirt provided by the Russians on Hillary Clinton. And Donald Trump Jr. said back in an email, love it, and then agreed to the meeting. The meeting wasn't about that at all. And as a consequence, the meeting ended abruptly. Along with Donald Trump Jr. was also Jared Kushner, Paul Manafort, who was then chairman of the Trump campaign. So if that's what Donald Trump Jr. is indicted on, that he lied about whether he told his father about the meeting or not, it would seem to me, Daniel, that the entire Trump base will consider that to be 100% pure political prosecution for political purposes. Because guess what? That doesn't prove that the Russian government did anything with the Trump administration, a Trump campaign, regarding collusion. I mean, it just doesn't.
No, it doesn't at all. I mean, first of all, I mean, I love that two-bit psychoanalysis about Trump Jr. craving the attention of the approval of his father. I mean, you know, the Intelligencer doesn't know anything about that. But number two, yes, it's just, I mean, you can really get anybody for these procedural offenses. Corsi, after being interrogated for hours by Mueller's team, said that his head was swimming. He couldn't remember one thing. You know, he couldn't remember what he said or what he didn't say. So in that kind of interrogation, yes, you can always find some contradiction, some misstatement that you can hang an indictment on, but it does not prove your larger case. And the larger case is of Russian collusion. That is essentially unproven. In fact, if anything, the fact that they're focusing in on all these peripheral players indicates that there really is no there. There really is no substance to the central charges.
You know, this makes me think, too. I think that this is going to cause more and more American people, American citizens, to say this whole special counsel law that we have is just not workable, because we see this time and time again over the course of more than a half a dozen presidencies so far, where a special counsel or special prosecutor is appointed and there is no there, but a whole bunch of people end up getting indicted and those indictments have nothing to do with the original accusation. And then you have to wonder, is this really the best way to spend the taxpayers' money? I would posit that it's not.
Yeah, but that goes for any kind of prosecution at all. I mean, when the FBI went after various the accused would-be terrorists, and used all kinds of entrapment techniques in order to somehow lure them into trying to somehow engage in a plot to blow a bomb up. I mean, those are the kinds of entrapment techniques that could be used against almost anybody. And the choice of a target is so obviously political. I mean, you could go after Zionist youth groups on the same basis. You can go after almost anybody and entrap them and lure them into a phony plot and then ruin their lives and send them to jail for a long time. So this kind of prosecutorial zeal is just completely out of control. And in this case, it's just after 2 years, it has just led to nothing substantial. And I don't think it will.
You know, I recommend this book all the time, and you've segued right into it. It's Three Felonies a Day, and it's written by Dr. Harvey Silverglade, a professor of law at Harvard University, who says that we're so over-criminalized in this country and over-regulated and over-legislated, with Congress creating 50 new crimes per year, not new laws, 50 new crimes per year. This is something that was legal last year that is illegal and a felony this year, that the average American on the average day going about his or her normal business commits three felonies. And so if they want to get you, the bottom line is they're going to get you, and there's literally nothing you can do to protect yourself. Especially as you say, and I agree with you completely, that we have this governmental overreach, this prosecutorial overreach, just as a matter of course. There's nothing you can do to protect yourself.
I think that's totally correct. I think it's really totally scary. I mean, you can protect yourself by mortgaging your house,
yeah,
to hire lawyers, and you'll go bankrupt, and you'll be ruined. But maybe you'll win at the end. But you'll pay an enormous price. And so these prosecutors really are just out of control. And Mueller is the most out of control of them all. I mean, he's been given a blank ticket to go after whomever he likes and whatever basis he likes, and it's just leading nowhere. It's ridiculous. You know, by the way, ABC News had a report that Paul Manafort, that Mueller is very upset about Paul Manafort not disclosing information about the Russia connection, and this is just a day or two ago. And, you know, I think the reason that Manafort is not disclosing information about the Russian connection is that there is no Russian connection.
I think that's it.
I mean, you know, he could be lying, he could be holding back, but more likely, I think, is he's telling the truth. There is no connection. As the Russian oligarch Oleg Deripaska told the FBI, this whole thing is preposterous. There was no major Russian attempt to put Trump in the White House. The Russians were as surprised as anybody when Trump got into the Oval Office on a constitutional fluke. They had no way of predicting that.
Daniel's assertion, if you tell that to people, most, quote, liberal people who are supporting the Democratic Party, they'll think, oh, no, you're a propagandist, mm-hmm. obviously, for mm-hmm. Russia. If
that's
you make
the Russian
that
narrative.
But Daniel, 15 seconds. I mean, that's what people would say to you. They'll say, what are you, a dupe for the Kremlin?
Oh, yeah, but it's an unprovable assertion. If I say the Russians did it, I'm right. And if I say the Russians didn't do it, I'm wrong. I mean, the whole thing, frankly, the whole thing reminds me of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, where people were convinced there was a cabal of Jews who were manipulating world events, and no amount of evidence could prove otherwise. And every bit of evidence seemed to support this narrative. But the whole thing is just asinine, and it keeps on going on.
And it's going to keep on going on, I fear. Well, we're going to leave it there. We were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Wildfires in Northern and Southern California continued to spread over the holiday weekend, resulting in 44 deaths and becoming the deadliest and most destructive wildfires in the state's history. More than 200 people are still missing. Meanwhile, President Trump tweeted that the fires are so severe only because of mismanagement by state fire prevention officials. That tweet was roundly condemned on both sides of the political aisle. We're joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff. He's a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation. Those are available from Monthly Review Press. Fred, welcome back.
Good to be here.
Fred, we talk about 100-year storms all the time or 100-year hurricanes. We've never seen fires like this, never. And it looks like we're going to go into the triple digits of deaths, unfortunately. What do you attribute this to? It's not like this is the first time that California has had a dry season.
No. As a matter of fact, California has really been in a drought with a one-year exception, if you will. That was 2016, 2017, one-year exception for about 4 or 5 years now. So it's been dry conditions for close to 5 years, with 1 year it being pretty wet, but not enough to really undo all of the, you know, all the dry conditions, not to replenish the groundwater and really completely replenish the soil. So and it is pretty dry this at this time of the year, which is when the rains normally come, starting, you know, October, November, and rains haven't been very plentiful, and the summer was exceptionally hot. As I'm sure the listeners remember, that this was a hot summer, not just in the United States and in California, but around the world. And so that helped to dry things out from last winter's rains. And now the winter rains are, you know, are slow in coming, or they're going to be less plentiful. And this year, 2018-2019, that the rains start around this time, and April, May, you know, June, July, and August, there's essentially no rainfall at all. So it has been exceptionally hot. It has been dry, and you put those two together, and you have a, you know, potential for catastrophe combined with one other factor, and that is the building of urban areas or suburban areas next to what they call wildlands, but basically, you know, forests and scrubland and, you know, with bushes and things like that. And once you have that interface where you're very close to that type of vegetation, you're set up for, you know, for catastrophe.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. It's not necessarily that things are different this fire season than they are any other time. But we are seeing sprawl like we've never seen before, whether it's urban sprawl or suburban sprawl, going into scrublands and brushlands and the sides of hills that otherwise have never seen development before. And, you know, even when a storm comes, or if a storm had come, we would probably be talking about mudslides in this conversation right now.
Yeah, no, in some of the areas, that's probably true. That frequently happens after a fire, where the vegetation is destroyed that is really helping to hold the soil in place, and you get some intense rainfalls and it just washes the soil away. Yeah, so I mean, it's a combination of things. Climate change is part of it for sure. The hot, dry summer certainly made things worse, and the heat this summer was most likely a result of climate change. I mean, the unusually long hot season that we had this summer, but it is that combination. It's also the building of suburbs and communities, entire communities, in areas where they are sooner or later going to be affected by a fire, you know, by a wildfire.
What about Donald Trump's, one of his original tweets, which was he blamed forest management as a cause? I mean, that created sort of an uproar that people were saying, well, that's insensitive. You're not demonstrating solidarity with the firefighters and the people living in California. John, what was it? What did the tweet say?
I've got the tweet here in front of me. He tweeted, this was on the 10th at 3:08 a.m. So he was up in the middle of the night.
He might
again.
Have been in France.
Well, that's right. He was in France. He said, there's no reason for these massive, deadly, and costly forest fires in California except that forest management is so poor. Billions of dollars are given each year with so many lives lost, all because of gross mismanagement of the forests. Remedy now or no more Fed payments! Exclamation point.
Go ahead, Fred.
Well, it's ridiculous, like most of the things that he tweets. There's no basis in reality. A lot of these fires are not in forests. Some are, certainly. But you also have the, just the grassland and brushland fires. How are you going to manage them? What are you going to do? I mean, there are ways to reduce them, reduce the volume of dry material there, but it's not what he's thinking about. What he's talking about is really this dogma that you should allow private loggers in hither and yon all over the place to thin the forest, or actually what they do a lot is to clear cut. And you remove the material that's flammable by doing that, but that really isn't the major issue here. These are forests that in the first place shouldn't be clear cut. They're providing important benefits to us in terms of slowing down water movement and helping the hydrologic cycle function and the biological aspects also as well, and natural, the wildlife that lives in them is important to keep going. So it's just a silly thing to tweet, especially so in the midst of the fires. I mean, the insensitivity of it is an understatement. It's just a gross misuse of communications by the person that holds the highest office in the country. It's unbelievable.
That's the voice of Fred Magdoff. We're talking to Fred from Burlington, Vermont. Fred is a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont, the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Towards a Revolutionary Transformation. Both of them are published by Monthly Review Press. I'm looking, Fred, at the headline from the Wall Street Journal this morning, 10:47 a.m. Here it is, pretty dramatic. Complete devastation, in quotes, as California fire death toll at 44. 80% of Paradise, the town, is destroyed. Grim toll rises after deadliest wildfire in California history. Fred, is this not simply the deadliest fire ever, but is this the future? Not the deadliest fire ever, but the deadliest wildfire of its type in California. But is this the future in California?
I think so. And also this time of the year, by the way, is when the deadliest fires happen. They're almost all in the fall. After the summer. Although, fires now in California, there used to be, this used to be the fire season or, the summertime or this period of time. But now you have wildfires almost any month of the year. So, yeah, I think this is what we're going to see in the future. It's that combination of where people live, in conjunction with, wild areas of vegetation, and you combine that with hotter and drier conditions, yes, I think this is what's going to happen in the future. This time of the year also, by the way, is when the Santa Ana winds, this is in Southern California, not that northern, the Paradise Fire, the fire that destroyed most of this community of Paradise is in Northern California. But the one that's burning right now in Southern California is being, literally fanned by the Santa Ana winds, which come at this time of the year.
And we have 30 seconds left. I mean, they're talking about hurricane force winds right now for today. So this is an annual feature of this part of the country?
It is. That's right. Dry winds,
hot and dry winds.
In fact, San Diego today is expecting 80 to 85 mile an hour gusts, and there's like literally no moisture in the air at all.
Yeah, that's, of course, the worst that can happen during a fire.
Absolutely. Well, we'll leave it there. We were joined from Burlington, Vermont by Fred Magdoff. Fred's a professor emeritus of plant and soil science at the University of Vermont and the co-author of What Every Environmentalist Needs to Know About Capitalism and Creating an Ecological Society Toward a Revolutionary Transformation, and that's from Monthly Review Press. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. A botched Israeli commando raid into Gaza late last night brought Israel and the Palestinians to the brink of full-out war before Egyptian mediators convinced both sides to step back from the brink. Israeli forces killed 7 Palestinians last night, an action which led to the largest-scale rocket fire into Israel since 2004. An Israeli officer was also killed. We're joined from Amman, Jordan by Dawood Kutab. He's an award-winning Palestinian journalist. Dawood, it's always good to have you.
Thank you very much, John, for having me.
Dawood, there's been this near state of war bubbling along for the last many months. Why did things go over the edge last night?
Well, it's very strange because things were moving in the direction of some type of a long-term ceasefire. The Egyptians have been very, very active in trying to convince Hamas and Israel to reach that agreement. And the Israelis seemed to be interested in it. Hamas was interested in it. The only ones who were not very happy about it were the Ramallah-based Palestinian leadership. Put that aside for now. And what happened is literally on the eve of this ceasefire coming into force, the Israelis took a stupid risk. There's an ongoing kind of a secret war over bodies or corpses or individuals that each side kind of is holding against each other. And so what the Israelis try to do is to use the appearance of quiet to sneak in a secret commando dressed as women to try to kidnap a leading Hamas official with the idea that they can use him as it's kind of a trading tool or trading card to bring back their soldiers or the corpses of their soldiers. Well, the guy resisted and they shot and killed him. And on their way out, the Palestinian forces shot at this kind of undercover commando and killed one of their leaders, who was apparently an Arab Druze from the Druze community, and injured a second. And that, of course, got the Israelis very angry, even though they're the ones who initiated the raid, and they started bombing Gaza, and then Hamas responded, and then, you know, it was tit for tat for a while.
This may be an overly simplified question, but what's in it for the Palestinians to stop fighting or to agree to a ceasefire?
Well, the ceasefire, obviously any ceasefire in the world has political conditions. Among them, for example, the bringing of money. The international banking system does not allow any money to be transferred to Hamas. And so even before this latest kind of round of violence, the Israelis and the UN agreed to allow $15 million in cash to be flown in to Gaza that was coming from Qatar, which was something that was badly needed by Hamas to pay their employees and so on. And, you know, hopefully what is in it for Hamas and for Palestinians in Gaza is that some of the restrictions that are on the borders would be lifted and life could become more normal. So there is something in it for Hamas for sure.
Tell me about the Egyptians. The Egyptians, it seems that the Egyptians are always playing the role of peacemaker. How were they able to get both sides to take a step back last night on such short notice as things seem to be spinning out of control?
Well, the Egyptian Rafah border is the only border for Gaza. So they're literally their lifeline for Gazans. In and out of Gaza is through Egypt. And so they have tremendous clout over Hamas. Now, as far as the Israelis are concerned, the Israelis basically have climbed up a high tree and they needed somebody to help them climb down the tree. they started the attack, but then Hamas responded with a barrage of rockets that basically shook up the entire south of Israel, with everybody kind of sleeping in their bunkers and so on. And that was not very comfortable for Israelis. So they didn't want to go through a war again. And so they wanted somebody to help them bring them down the tree. So the Egyptians were happy to do that. And Hamas was willing to do it.
I see. You know, I am always confused as to how the state of play is constantly changing. And it seems to me, Daoud, that after all these years, there doesn't seem to be really an end game. It seems that everything is tactical. It's one day to the next. Is there any hope at all of any kind of a long-term ceasefire or an end to the state of siege against Gaza? Is there anything that the Egyptians might be able to negotiate between the Palestinians and the Israelis?
I think there is, if people kind of change where they stand. Hamas has refused to clearly and publicly recognize Israel and basically allow the PLO to basically do the negotiation. The Israelis have totally rejected to recognize Hamas. And as long as this kind of lack of recognition continues, the only thing that seems to work is a kind of a mutual terror. So both sides are terrorizing each other, and that in a very strange way seems to work.
And what about domestic Israeli politics? Is there more than one side to this, or has everybody on the Israeli side lined up behind Netanyahu?
It's hard to say. I would say that Netanyahu is in trouble because they basically brought Gaza to the brink of war, but basically he blinked first. And so Hamas did not kind of kneel down for him. They shot back in a powerful way. And I think he had a very difficult choice, either to go to war or to climb down. And so the fact that he has climbed down is not going to bode very well for him if there's going to be elections next March, as the rumors are.
Yeah, what would that look like? Because, you know, the domestic Israeli politics have turned out to be Netanyahu and everybody else. And there's nobody else besides Netanyahu who can cobble together.
Until now, and, you know, elections have a kind of a life of their own. But until now, it was Netanyahu's elections to be lost. I mean, he was entering the kind of phase in very high marks with very high polling numbers. I think when the dust settles down on this particular round, I think he would be politically clobbered.
Really?
I think so. If you add to that the numerous investigations and scandals, and the latest one has to do with the German submarine in which the senior staffers of his are all being indicted. If that continues, that type of kind of drip scandal information, I don't think it's going to do very well. But you're right on one count, which is that even if Netanyahu's stock is going down, we haven't really seen anybody appear to kind of take that place of Netanyahu and kind of be a strong, you know, like Paris versus Rabin or Rabin versus Netanyahu. We don't have any kind of powerful figure like that now.
You know, that's really, without getting too far afield, I actually wanted to ask you about that. It used to be in the not too distant past that the Israeli Labor Party was strong enough to be able to form governments. And in fact, for a long stretch, the Labor Party was the only party that was able to form governments. And then the Labor Party sort of went away. It seems also that people are wistful for the days of the Labor Party because they were willing to talk to the Palestinians. Do you see anybody or any party emerging post Netanyahu that might be willing to sit down at the table again with the Palestinians, including the Gaza Palestinians?
No, I don't. Actually, you know, it used to be like it was in America, center-left versus center-right or something to that effect. And now everything's polarized like it is in America. You have far-right, basically, and far-left. There is nobody's in the center anymore. And I would say in Israel, the same happens. The only difference is that the right-wing leader is very charismatic and powerful, and the left is scattered and disorganized and cannot really agree on a single leader and a single direction. And so whereas in America, the Democratic Party seems to have put themselves together and to fight against against Trump, I don't see anything similar to that yet happening in Israel. The, you know, Meretz and even the Labor Party are really very weak, and the fighting is mostly in the, I would say, center right versus far right rather than anything else. So you have lots of settler groups, you have the Jewish National Group, you have the Likud, and you know the Labor Party is just one small faction now rather than the big faction as it used to be.
We have about 30 seconds left. What do you think we should expect to see in the coming days?
I would think there might be a little, you know, small rounds here and there, but I think as soon as this current ceasefire discussion, which seems to have, you know, basically, as I said, Israel blinked already and the Hamas has agreed to that. I think once that settles down, I think we will have a few months of quiet until the next round. And a lot depends on the basically back agreements, some of the agreements behind the scenes of how much the Israelis will be willing to lift the siege, what's going to happen on, you know, bringing electricity and gasoline in for the electricity, how much the borders would be open for people to move people and goods. So the issues of Gaza, I think, are all connected. The economic issues are connected to the security issues. And if the economic issues are eased, I think there will be some easing of the security ones.
Okay, that was the voice of Daoud Kutab, who joined us from Amman. Daoud is an award-winning Palestinian journalist. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and we'll come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Brian, I had the occasion last week to sit in Athens with former Greek finance minister Yanis Varoufakis and with renowned UBS whistleblower Brad Birkenfeld. We talked about whistleblowing in the financial and banking sectors and about Varoufakis' experience standing up to the troika of the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Central Bank, which was then in control of the Greek economy. Varoufakis began the conversation by talking about his plans with Senator Bernie Sanders and other international progressive leaders to found a new international progressive movement. They'll make an official announcement in New York later in the month. In Greece, he and like-minded progressives also have formed a new political party that would compete against the ruling Syriza party and the conservative New Democracy Party, which is widely expected to win national elections that'll be held sometime in the first half of next year. Varoufakis also told me about treason charges leveled against him by Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras based on Varoufakis' decision to stand up to the Troika and to German Chancellor Angela Merkel and his threat to withdraw Greece from the Eurozone. When the idea proved to be a bad one, he said, Tsipras turned on him and accused him of, quote, attempting to subvert the national currency, unquote. That apparently constitutes treason in Greece, although the case is expected to drag on for many years. So let's start by listening to a clip about Varoufakis' plans in international politics.
I'm an anti-Trump person.
Yes,
but
that's right.
I'm equally anti-Clinton Obama.
That's exactly my position.
National, you know, as you know, I'm a friend of Bernie Sanders.
Yes.
We're starting something together now. On the 30th of November, Bernie and I are going to launch what we call the Progressive International. So an international political movement with a structure, not just
yes.
talk.
Yes.
And a global economic policy. In the International New Deal, we're going to call it.
Oh my God, that's fantastic.
A new Bretton Woods system and blah, 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 blah. But it will be a long time coming. But it will be an announcement on the 30th of November.
Well, I'm not here to tell you how to do it, but you should probably pull in another person from, say, like maybe the UK or Scandinavia that has similar.
This is just the announcement.
Yes, yeah.
The open call.
Yes.
Good.
Jeremy Corbyn is part of it.
Oh, he's great.
Oh, there you go. Okay. So
John McDonnell from Britain. the Icelandic prime minister, who's a friend.
Fantastic.
Yeah, he contacted me as well.
You know, people from India and Nigeria and Ghana. And
wow.
So
that's exactly what we need.
Genuinely.
Legitimate.
Genuinely international.
And generally international.
And please join us.
Brian, domestic Greek politics are still very important to Varoufakis, and really he wants to try to rehabilitate his reputation. He's certainly famous and highly respected outside of Greece, but inside Greece he feels like he's really taken it on the chin. And so he is looking at this new political party, something that's going to be sort of middle of the road, but really progressive in its outlook, and he's going to take on the sitting government. Let's listen to his comments about that.
It's a political issue. I'm not using lawyers. I'm doing something even more aggressive than that.
Okay.
We are running for parliament now, so create a new party.
Good.
So.
Good.
That's so. We established it last March.
Fantastic.
So we're going for it.
Brian, the charge of treason is one of the gravest charges that any human being can be charged with, and in many cases, in many countries, including here in the United States, it carries with it the death penalty. Well, here you have one of the most respected political figures in Greece, in Yanis Varoufakis, the former minister of finance, and he was charged with treason. So here's the story that he tells. He says that his job was to get the best deal for Greece that he possibly could in his negotiations with the German government and with the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Central Bank. Well, the only way to do that, the only way to protect Greek workers, the only way to protect those workers' pensions was to threaten the Troika and the Germans. And so what he did was he said, listen, if we don't get a decent deal here, we are going to withdraw from the Eurozone, we're going to drop the use of the euro, and we're going to go back to the drachma. Now, the drachma was in use for more than 2,000 years in Greece, going all the way back to ancient times. The Greeks like the drachma. It's an historic currency, and he was willing to go back to it. What that served to do, besides frightening the Germans and the Troika, was that it weakened the euro against the dollar. Now, that ought to be a good thing, because if the euro is weaker against the dollar, it's easier and cheaper to export European goods. That puts more Europeans back to work, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, the Greeks saw it the opposite way. They saw that as subverting the national currency, with the national currency being the euro. And if you're going to punish a political rival, what better way than to charge him with the gravest crime that you can think of, the most horrible crime that's on the books in your country, and that's treason. When I said to Varoufakis that I thought this was a gross overreaction, he laughed and he said that this is sort of typical in Greece. This is what politicians do to other politicians to discredit them. And I asked him how he could travel internationally from country to country when he has this horrible criminal charge hanging over his head. And he said that that was really nonsense, because you can be charged with treason and the case will take 15 years, 20 years before it ever sees the inside of a courtroom. And by then everybody's moved on and there's nobody left to testify against you and the thing just goes away. So let's listen to what he had to say about that.
So the situation is really very simple. I was the only minister of finance that tried those methods that I explained to you before, and also who would not sign on the dotted line of a new loan agreement on the basis that if you're bankrupt, you have no moral or political right to take on more loans until you restructure the previous loans.
Yes,
yeah,
of
I mean,
course.
Otherwise you're extending and pretending. Otherwise,
yes,
you do a savings and loan thing. You should be in prison,
precisely,
which is what every other minister of finance did. And of course,
yes,
and that made me extremely unlikable amongst the, you know, the powers that be.
But certainly, people understood that the crisis was so bad that business as usual just was not going.
But that's why I was so popular and I was elected.
Yes.
But the people who had already indebted Greece and had taken on these extended pretend loans, they looked at me as a finance minister that was the only finance minister who was ever popular in the history of Greece, right? Because I was not doing that.
And
I had to be eliminated politically.
Yes.
The other reason was that I had a plan for deterring the European Central Bank from closing down the banks here.
Mm.
Because this was their leverage. against the government. They were asphyxiating us in order to sign on the dotted line. And how were they doing it? How were they throttling us? By threatening, by creating a bank run, because there's nothing easier than the chairman of the Fed creating a bank run. Imagine that, the chairman of the Fed saying, I think there's going to be a bank run. That's it, there's a bank run.
Boom.
It's like the fire brigade saying, yeah. Fire.
Fire.
We're all burning.
Run.
Run. In their fireman's uniforms, right? So they did that here. And they were threatening to switch off liquidity to the banks. They were closing it, but not switching it off immediately. And the reason why I was finance minister was that I had a deterrence plan. And I had told Tsipras, who then became prime minister and appointed me, and he had approved it. And the deterrence plan comprised two parts. One was, if you close down our banks, I'm going unilaterally to default on bonds that the European Central Bank owns. If I do that, then you will have serious trouble buying more bonds from Italy, and then Italy's out of the euro. If Italy's out of the euro is gone.
It's finished.
So you know, I had a deterrence. A doomsday thing. Which would hurt them a lot more than us. So that was part A of the plan. Part B was more technically interesting. The problem with closed banks is that the payment system dries up. That's the main problem.
Liquidity, yep.
The payment system. Suddenly you have a modern economy, quasi-modern economy, which simply does not function because your people cannot make payments, even if they have the money in the bank.
Yeah.
So I was planning a parallel payment system, digital parallel payment system. I had it ready, which was very, very simple, technically very simple, and I think could have been used to good effect. So the idea is we use the website of the tax office. Every tax file number is given a reserve account. So if I can't put money in people's hands to pay their pension, for instance, because they closed down the banks, I can simply type 1,000 euros in that reserve account and give them a PIN number.
Right.
Just type it.
Boom.
And give them an opportunity to this PIN number to transfer it to any other account of any other tax file.
Wow.
So suddenly you have a parallel payment system which is outside the banking system.
Which is much more efficient.
And I was already developing with computer scientists apps for phones so you can do it quickly and you can make payments in shops. And all euro-denominated, all in the euro, you close down my banks. I will blow up your QE by haircutting your bonds, and I will set up my own parallel payment system. So,
Europeans must have loved this idea, though. No,
they hated it because they wanted to control us. It's all politics.
Of course, it's political. It's not.
They understood that it was a good idea.
Yeah,
and that's why they hated it.
Because they weren't in charge of it.
Yeah, exactly. So, going back to the treason charge.
Yes.
What is the charge for? Listen to this. This is deliciously ironic.
I've never understood this.
No. Wait. The charge is very, very simple. For subverting the national currency. Which is the national currency?
There's no national currency.
The euro. So I'm being accused of plotting to subvert the euro system, the European Central Bank, which is the national currency of Greece, by setting up a parallel payment system. So that is the charge. The charge is that I was undermining and subverting the national currency.
But in fact, you were strengthening the national currency.
Yeah, of course.
You were enhancing the system.
Of course. So it's a completely absurd charge.
It is absurd.
But it comes under national... Oh, yeah, a band of lawyers motivated by the opposition party.
Do you know exactly who they are?
Yeah, I do.
You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear. Thank you.